This is program number 8 of the current series of broadcasts scheduled for KTAR Phoenix. This is a broadcast I've been wanting to do for days. It concerns that barehanded fighter, the G.I. Joe, Bob, Ed, and the other boys who know more about this war than any other variety of soldier could possibly know. I use the term barehanded because any GI will tell you that his battle with the enemy is a matter of about 90% conditions and 10% Japanese opposition. That sounds incredible to anyone who hasn't seen these islands of the Pacific, but actually the ratio of difficulty posed by these percentages is pretty accurate. Let's take a look at the physical problem that faces the GI. He's the point of every attack that is carried out. His battleground has stretched from the bottomless mud of Leyte, the jungles of New Guinea, to the rugged hills of Luzon and the other islands in the Philippine group. I talked to GIs who have lived on the line, the actual combat line, for weeks with nothing under them for a bed but the ground, and nothing over them but the night sky and the blazing sun of the daytime hours. The rainfall here and south of here is so great that in a matter of minutes, inches of water will come down in torrents. This means that the GI on the line is soaked to the skin from head to foot a great deal of the time. For days, he will never take his clothes off. Through it all, he must eat the packaged rations issued to him. They have ample food value to sustain good health, but even so, nothing can take the place of a hot meal at least once in a while. As the attack moves on, sometimes swiftly, the GI and his buddies outrun the convenience of the aid stations on which they must depend for medical treatment. Before they know it, they'll be 2 or 3 days in advance of the field hospitals. This means that when a man is wounded, he must endure the delay and discomfort of having to be carried on a litter the entire distance back to a field hospital that may be miles. To be sure, the medics in the frontline areas exercise every ounce of skill and facility at their command in giving emergency treatment. But in many cases, even the excellence of this care is not enough to eliminate the immediate necessity for major hospitalization. So the GI finds himself strategically well-situated, militarily speaking, but too often sadly out of reach of the essential services from the rear. It's usually an unavoidable situation. The foot soldier can, when the opposition permits, make very rapid progress over even the most isolated country, and naturally he presses on continuously toward the enemy. On the other hand, the services of supply and hospitalization in the rear are faced with elaborate equipment that simply can't be run in where the GI moves so readily by foot. Finally, balance or some semblance of it is restored when the point troops meet stiffer opposition and are slowed to a pace that can be either matched or improved on by the rear echelons. If this were a civilized type of operation, handy roads would make it easy to keep the armies intact at all times. As it is, the GI's reference to conditions amounting to fully 90% of his troubles in the field is, as I said a moment ago, a pretty accurate description of the situation. When it comes to praise as handed out by the GI to the majority, it goes largely to the medics, who are a part of every squad, no matter where the combat group may be. I've listened with the deepest personal admiration to the heartfelt tributes that the GI offers in behalf of the medic. They seem to have no fear whatsoever. From somewhere, they have drawn a conception of beauty that overlooks their own safety seemingly completely. GI fighters will be dug in, pinned down by the severest kind of enemy fire. A boy is hit, perhaps 25 or 30 yards from the squad medic. The call goes out, "Medic, medic." The response is immediate. Bullets or no bullets, the medic soldier wades in to administer emergency care. In thousands of cases, that quick attention is the difference between life and death for the wounded veteran. Still, the field medic goes forward as an unsung hero. Only last evening, I spent a few hours with a field hospital doctor who told me stories of field medic accomplishments that seem almost impossible. Perhaps someday, the full story of their unselfish, unarmed service will be told, and the credits due them will be set down as indelible proof of what men will do for each other in the face of danger and death. The other evening, there was time for a couple of leisure hours with a trio of GIs who had just arrived from the lines. As we sat around, shooting the breeze, as they call it, I gathered such facts as these. Sergeant Ed Calusa of the 6th Infantry Division gave Chisholm, Minnesota, as his home. After learning that he had worked in the iron mines back home, I offered the opinion that he would probably find the old life pretty tame after his months of combat. The sergeant's reply was characteristic of the GI attitude. Said he, "That I will appreciate." Sergeant Calusa is a squad leader with a record that has been equaled or surpassed by very few field leaders in this war or any other war for that matter. He has led the 12 men of his squad through almost 200 days of combat without the loss of a single man. To meet Sergeant Calusa is to realize why our field commanders are so quick to praise the seasoned noncom. They are the backbone of the field forces, the real generals in the foxholes. The safety of the private corporal and the run-of-the-mill members of the combat squad is almost completely the responsibility of the top sergeant. Of course, Sergeant Calusa refuses to take more than passing credit for the splendid record he has made. It is still true that his leadership has accounted for a known total of 55 Japs killed and no losses for his own squad. One of the members of the Calusa squad is Henry Booth of Whiteside, Kentucky. Henry is the BAR, Browning Automatic Rifleman, of the squad. His personal record shows that he has killed 31 Japs without receiving a single scratch. Private Booth says it's just like gunning for squirrels or rabbits, except that the game would be better described if called rats. Henry is a quiet sort. He listens more than he talks, but his sergeant tells me privately that in the field, under any and all kinds of conditions, Henry Booth is the sharpest shooter he has ever seen. In a single brush with the enemy, he dispatched a total of 9 Japs in less than 2 minutes. The coal mines of Kentucky will look mighty good to Henry Booth when this is all over. Joe Albanez of the 124th Infantry, 31st Division, was the other member of the trio. Fall River, Massachusetts is Joe's home. He was a shirt factory worker when the Army reached to him. Today he's not so certain about returning to that old job. He says, I may try something in civil service. I'm anxious to get hold of something steady. Joe is one of those very rare individuals with a sense of humor that surpasses even his most aggravating experiences. He kept us roaring with laughter as he talked about how sickly he was throughout all the days of his early youth. Why, he says, my mother had me in every doctor's office within reach. I was always sick with something. And now, since I'm in the Army, I haven't been able to catch a thing. I haven't been sick a single day, and every other guy I meet manages sooner or later to get one of those hospital cots with white sheets and all that stuff. Joe told it for the absolute truth, that the night before was the first time since mid-January that he hadn't slept on the ground. In Joe's opinion, the order fixed bayonets is the worst thing that ever comes down the line. It means close contact with the enemy, and the boys have no desire to get that close to a live Jap. And finally, in his very best style, Joe said, boy, when I get home, I'm going to be looking for peace. When this is over, I wouldn't even join the women's club for fear they'd decide to mobilize. The three boys involved in this conversation were united in a variety of opinions about things in general. Specifically, they were absolutely positive of this. The Jap is no dummy in the field, no matter who says he is. His tactics at times are amazingly brilliant. Then, of course, at other times, he does the craziest kind of things, things no American soldier would ever think of doing in connection with his own safety. And all this makes him a confusing, unorthodox adversary who is consistently deadly in the field. A sniper will cling to the top of a tree for hours. He'll let 50 boys pass by without firing a shot. Then he'll kill the 51st. The answer is this. They establish a positive line of fire. They point their rifle and fix it. And then they hold their fire until someone walks into the line of that fire and they cut loose. Bang goes the Jap's rifle and another of our boys is hit. Their machine guns are set in the same way. By using this method, they manage to keep their positions concealed. A single shot from a rifle doesn't give the rifleman's position away, that is, generally. A quick blast from a machine gun tells nothing unless our boys happen to be looking right at the spot where the gun is buried. The fire is deadly because every time a gun goes off, someone has walked into the line of fire and is either hurt or killed. Many other similarly well-thought-out tactics make the GI's war with the Jap an endless struggle for the upper hand. Our GIs are definitely superior fighters in every department of the game, man for man. But again, the factor of conditions being 90% of the battle equalizes things in ways that are sometimes very hard to overcome. I wish it were possible for me to give you just a few of the very highly personalized experiences of the GIs I've met. Most of the stories they tell have to be reserved, however, for more private discourses than are possible in the usual broadcast presentation. Suffice it to say that the GI isn't going to cause anyone a nickel's worth of anxiety when he returns home. Henry Booth may kill 100 Japs over here, but when he lays that old PAR down for home, right then and there, he's going to forget the whole thing just as fast as he can, and you can take it from him personally. Sergeant Calusa isn't going to go back to the States with bitterness in his heart. because of what he has seen and endured. He's going to marry some very nice girl, find a little home for himself and the family to be, and spend the remainder of his days enjoying the American citizenship he was willing to risk his life to protect. Private Joe Albanaz and hundreds of others just like him will go home tickled pink to be alive and well, proud as the dickens for the privilege they have made the most of, and positively ready for the interests that are as American as the courage that is bringing our men victory against the suicidal Japanese in these fields and forests here on this side of the world. The most exciting and completely satisfying thing that happens to the average GI is the occasional opportunity he has to meet someone fresh from home. His questions are the perfectly normal inquiries of an American boy. His hopes are the same. The GI soldier is just as sick of combat as you are of rationing. He lives for the day when he can once again be Joe Doakes instead of GI Joe. Welcome him home when he comes. Treat him just like you always did. And once you all get acquainted again, you'll never know he's been away. Meanwhile, write to him. Tell him all the news from home and do it often. They crave it more than anything else in the world right now. And you are the ones who can make the going easier for them by following through on this simple suggestion. Okay, Fred, that's all for this time.